Welcome to The Storyfield. This is a podcast created and sponsored by the Allen Firm. This is Josh Allen, and I'm joined by Micah Petrie. I think you'll agree that life is complex, business is hard, and living a life of faith can feel complicated. We know it's discouraging when movement in your life or business or faith has stopped. Well, you're in the right place to hear some great stories of normal people just like us who will inspire you to move forward in life. So thank you for joining us today. We know you're going to be encouraged. How's it going, Storyfield? I am super excited about today. Today's going to be great. We have Joel Condren on. So Joel, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
So it's a little special for us and pretty unique because Joel, you're a resident of South Fork, Colorado, which is one of my personal favorite places ever. So, you know, Joel, I did want to ask you kind of on a less serious note, before we really get into some of the, you know, the story, if anyone in Colorado hears about you talking to a few Texans on the interview, is that going to be okay?
Well, in Southern Colorado, talking to a Texan is a normal thing.
Okay. It's unavoidable in the summer and winter.
It's unavoidable year round.
Okay.
You don't try and avoid it. It's welcome.
Okay. Well, you know, kind of the inside. Go ahead, Micah.
And plus, Josh, you're there all the time. So
yeah,
You're basically half and half now.
Yeah.
It's probably not talking to Texans we're worried about. It's talking to Josh.
Worried about. Okay. That's right. Well, you know, the inside joke with Texas is Colorado used to be, used to be Texas. So I'm sure you heard all that.
Exactly. Anyway,
well, Joel, you have a fascinating story. Let me give you just a little bit of bio. And then we're going to dive in. So I think today we're really going to get to hear and learn about entrepreneurship. And really the word I keep thinking of really is risk, you know, running businesses and hopefully some fly fishing and maybe some winter sports tips and where to go from a man who's in the middle of it all. So Joel, you're the owner of 8200 Mountain Sports.
Yes.
And that's a sales and rentals of all things winter, summer, rafting, kayaks, paddle, just
guide
all that
service,
fun stuff.
Everything. Yep.
Okay. And then and a guide service as well for fishing. And then another business is Mountain Man Rafting.
Correct.
And from what I've learned is that's the only guided rafting company operating on the Upper Rio Grande.
That's correct. Mountain Man was founded by another individual in 85, and we purchased it in 2013. And it is the only permits granted by the U.S. Forest Service to provide guided rafting on the Upper Rio.
That's amazing. Well, we can't wait to hear a little more about that. Now, also, you're a real estate lender, investor, and
yes,
switchback liquor store owner. So that's why I think we're going to cover the gamut today.
Yeah. Yeah, if I don't get you at the recreation business, I get you at the liquor store. Yeah,
so we have a lot to learn. So not only I think I need to mention too, which I really appreciate your service. You are a very community and service minded person. So you're a volunteer serving on the Trout Unlimited board.
Yes.
Okay. The South Fork Marketing Board.
Yes, sir.
The president of the board of the South Fork Fire Protection District.
That is correct.
And then president of the board of the Rio Grande Hospital and correct, past president of the Chamber of Commerce. So
that's correct. I think in these small towns, big towns too, but in small towns like South Fork, everything runs off of a volunteer basis. And I feel that everybody who lives here has to pay their dues in one form or at one time or another. I don't live in town limits. I'm just outside of town limits. So I cannot serve on the board of directors for the town of South Fork or run for mayor or any of that. So I've made my decision to help through other avenues.
Okay, that's great. And that's an encouragement just for people to get involved. Well, we kind of like to run this on just kind of from young, you know, just kind of a life chronology. But before we do that, first tell us, give people who don't have any idea where South Fork is, tell us a little bit about where it is. What is it? What's the population? Just give us the rundown on South Fork. Sure.
So South Fork, Colorado is in Southern Colorado, sort of South Central. I would say Southwestern, but we are on the east side of the Continental Divide. So many listeners may be familiar with Durango. That would be on the west slope. So that would be sort of our neighbor on the other side of the slope or on the other side of the hill. South Fork is a tiny little town. It was a timber community originally that supported the mining community, which took place in Creed, Colorado, which is upriver 21 miles. So no mining down here, but great timber industry. The timber mill was our source of income for many generations and was operational into early 2000s when wholesale lumber pricing fell out. They had to close the mill down. And then that is when tourism really started to pick up along the Rio Grande drainage. You know, the locals were making their living elsewhere, and those that stayed had to figure out what to do. And tourism was growing at the time. South Fork has always been known to Texans and Southerners. Let's stop saying just Texas.
Yeah.
South Fork really started to grow after the lumber mill closed, and we started gearing towards marketing towards the recreation industries.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, that's fascinating. I didn't even know that about South Fork either. So
our population, according to the last census, we've gone down. So the population of South Fork is right around 400. That's in town limits.
Whereas what does it swell to? I mean, in the summer, do you have any idea?
10,000. Guys, we have one campsite that holds over 4,000 people. So it fills up along with all the other lodging entities, vacation rentals, short-term rentals, etc. So easily 10,000 in the summertime. In the wintertime, it's a little more cyclical, where we see the big holiday crowds coming to ski Wolf Creek ski area, which is only 17 miles from us. So we see those holiday crowds at Christmas, Martin Luther King weekend, President's weekend, and spring break.
Okay. Well, that's great. Okay. Well, thanks for setting that stage for us. Now, let's back up. So you grew up in the New England area. So let's kind of take from childhood. So tell us about your childhood. Like, where'd you grow up? What was it like? Your family, that type of thing.
I was actually born in Indiana. My father was a student at Purdue, which is where he met my mother. Upon graduation, he took a professor job, a teaching job at University of Vermont. So we lived in Burlington, Vermont for a while. And then his specialty, he's a civil engineer in dealing in wastewater treatment. And then he took a job cleaning up dirty water within the pulp and paper industry in Portland, Maine. So we lived in Portland for a while, which was an absolute great place to grow up. Our family was very out of doorsy, did a lot of camping, hunting, and fishing. And New England is a great place to do that. And then in the early 80s, I was in junior high school, and my father took a position in Los Angeles for another firm that deals in wastewater treatment, this time in sewage treatment. So we moved from one coast to the other, and I spent from 80 to 96 in Southern California, just north of Los Angeles, about an hour.
Well, let me ask you, do you remember, I'm going to kind of pick your long-term memory. What was that like for a junior high kid to like uproot and move coasts? I mean, that's incredible.
Seventh grade is an awkward time at best for most people, and moving from New England to LA. And I had that New England accent really bad. So we would take the car and go to the park. And that is how I sounded. I mean, I was the epitome of a New England accent. And when you land in Los Angeles and no one sounds like that, I recall standing in front of the bathroom mirror practicing my R's. Yeah. I'm going to take the car and go to the park because I was going to get beat up or something pretty badly.
And just the population. I mean, from where you were, the change in that had to be pretty tremendous as well.
Yeah, it was staggering. But it was also a very fun, impressionable time. Southern California has a lot to offer.
Yeah.
Not for everybody, right? You know, not everybody likes that, but I certainly embraced it and enjoyed California.
So were you able to ever get out and surf?
No, I never. Yeah, we went to the beach. But again, as I mentioned before, growing up camping, fishing and hunting, that was sort of my forte. Yeah. And where we lived in California, which was Valencia, California, you know, we had deer, bear, mountain lion, quail, fishing. So right out my backyard, we continued with the recreation, with the outdoor recreation. Surfing wasn't one of them. The beach was only 40 minutes away, and we would visit the beach, but I didn't surf.
Yeah, that's interesting.
So did you, just real quick, when you got the Cali, did you start talking like the Californian? Like, hey, brah, like, get on the boards in the pools, man.
I probably did. Anything in seventh grade, you do anything at all to get accepted. I know I said rad and dude. You know, and I think that's about when shortly after that, that movie Valley Girl with Nicolas Cage came out, and that sort of brought to light the how Southern Californians may or may not talk. So, yes, I'm certain I sounded like that at some point.
I always find that interesting how people, when they go from one area to the other, like you said, like you're talking, you're from Boston. And your long eyes and all this stuff.
Exactly.
And then you're like, oh man, like for sure. It's just funny. Cause then it can happen in like a year.
Yeah. And now living in Southern Colorado, I've picked up that Texas.
Yeah.
You know, I live with a Texan. Paige is from, she's from Fort Worth. So now it's y'all.
Yeah.
What are y'all doing?
Yeah.
And you I say that when I talk to people in California and they just laugh.
I have a buddy who makes fun of me for my eyes. What's nice? You're nice.
Nice.
You
know,
so where did you graduate from high school then? Was it
from Saugus High School, which is in Saugus, California.
Okay. And so I noticed just kind of in some of the initial things we were talking about, that from there, from high school, you decided not to pursue a college degree. So I really appreciate that, Joel. And I want you to encourage somebody, kind of tell us about that story, but encourage the people who like say, man, college is not for me, or I don't want to go, you know.
My father, as I've mentioned, he was a civil engineer, PhD in civil engineering. He was the smartest man I knew. And in high school, I was a very average student. And in speaking to the old man, you know, dinner time or whatever, I simply came out and said, I don't know why I would like to go to college. I don't know what I want to do after college. So why would I go to college to study one thing when I don't know what I'm going to do after college? And I was able to see others that had gone to college and were not using their degree. So that was confusing to me. Again, just being so smart, I didn't want to go try and pursue one thing and force myself into that. And my father said, you know, there are trades that will never go out of style. People always have to eat. So you could be a chef, or you could own a restaurant or something along that line. People always have to live. They live in a house, and the house needs to be built. You have to have plumbing. You have to have electrical, roofing, air conditioning, et cetera. So he was smart enough to not force me into a college that I was not prepared for, but rather encouraged me to pursue something that I would enjoy. Our next door neighbor was an electrician, and throughout high school, I would help him on jobs sort of as a side gig. I did a little quick research and found that electricians do okay. I pursued that right out of high school. I got a job with an electrical contractor, and then applied for work with Southern California Edison, which is a utility company, sort of like PG&E. Mm-hmm. And then eventually was hired by Edison, and they send you to school. So, you know, they're going to teach you how to understand electrical theory and electrical practices. Which some of which I had already gleaned as being an electrician right out of high school.
So Now, I'm a little ignorant in this area. I mean, just kind of on the, you hear about master electricians. I mean, is that something that you end up going to school for, or after a while you become that with your experience, or both? Or
yeah, if you were working for an electrical contractor, you would become a journeyman electrician. If it was union, it's a little bit different. Okay. But that is a qualification that the state would award you. And then working for Edison, all of that takes place in-house. You'd become a journeyman electrician or a journeyman lineman. Okay. And that's done within the realm of Southern California Edison.
Okay. So how long were you with Edison, and kind of what level did you get to?
I started as a meter reader, which is the entry level position. And then you transfer over to field services, and basically you're a grunt on a field crew. And the field crews are the guys that go out and either work overhead or underground. And, you know, at first, the only thing they allow you to touch is a shovel and a broom, because they don't want to hurt you. And you start to go to school, and then as positions open up, I took a apprenticeship where you start to learn how to climb and learn electrical principles and theories. That's a 3-year program. About 2 years into it, 2.5 years into it, I decided that climbing wasn't for me. I still enjoyed the electrical practices and the theory, and electricity didn't bother me, but I decided that heights, that's for the birds. That you know, standing or climbing up a 95-foot bare pole and then looking down, I had this little reality check, like, what am I doing? This is kind of crazy. And so I moved into I moved into the planning department and on the operational side of field services, starting to learn behind the scenes work that supported the guys out in the field.
Okay.
Well, and I ended up working for Edison for about 9 years.
Okay.
And then through a series of life occurrences, I decided that it was time to leave Southern California.
Okay. And that's what I want to get into next. But first, a little side note, we do have a small common ground, because I was summer help for our electric co-op here in town. Oh, yeah. It was on the line overhead. And so I know what you mean by grunt. I mean, like, yeah. I rode with the digger, and they always tried to get the hydraulic tamper stuck so they could just like
let you
kill you, you know, like, so they were, it was a very character growing crowd to work with.
And I think, you know, you're right. It's character growing. And I think it's a great part of an education. You know, college is going to provide you one form of education. And the practical side of a lot of that is, you know, did you work in the field? So before you go into the planning department, were you educated in college to be a planner, or did you come from field services where you actually understand how to dig a hole, how to set a pole, how to climb a pole, how to string wire? So each of those bring certain aspects to a job. So growing and learning with in-field practice is very important.
Oh, for sure. Well, I appreciate that, because just talking about that, and I'm sure you don't regret any of that. Like, it was just a good decision and such a helpful thing. And I'm not sure that's not the path to go for a lot of people.
I agree.
Yeah, I was going to say, a lot of, at least here in Texas, a lot of the schools are now building what's called CTE programs that, you know, there's a whole group of kids that don't need to go to college. Like,
right.
Let's learn a skill. And then as soon as you're done with high school, boom, you're out welding or being a nurse or those kinds of things.
You know, we all grew up, we probably had wood shop or auto shop or something like that in school. And I think there's a generation behind me that they did not learn a lot of practical skills. You know, their life is different. It's a little more electronic, a little more tech-based. So same thing locally here. I think some of the local schools are teaching electricity. Auto and woodworking are back in, and, you know, even welding classes. So they're teaching some very valuable skill sets for other kids that may, just like me, may not go to college, but a kid may become an electrician and then ultimately may start his own electrical business.
And really do well without strapped with so much debt and all that as well. So thanks for sharing that. Well, let's get you to South Fork. So how did you make the move to South Fork from Southern California?
You know, the early 90s in LA were a bit rough. We had some pretty heavy duty earthquakes, the Rodney King riots. There was some tension. I had a very quick marriage and an even quicker divorce. And I don't know how this happens, but at some point, maybe it's a one day thing, but maybe it's over a longer period of time where you sort of open your eyes and you realize that you're not happy in your current situation. So for me, standing on top of that 95-foot bare pole, and I realized that I didn't want to climb anymore. Now, I didn't stop climbing the very next day. There's a process we all go through to evaluate why this feeling has come to the forefront. And then quite honestly, what do I want to do after I stop climbing?
Well, that moment was a key moment for you.
That literally was a moment. I'm on top of this pole on Santa Monica Boulevard looking down. And I said, what in the heck am I doing? And then several years later, I woke up one morning and I said, what the heck am I doing here in Southern California? I've always enjoyed the recreation. We've touched on that. I had been to South Fork numerous times on hunting and fishing trips with friends. And I said to myself, I'm selling everything and I'm going to go to Colorado. Mm-hmm. My sister lived in Boulder, so that was an easy thing. But I told myself I would stop off in South Fork for 1 year, fish, and enjoy, sort of get my head on straight. I was 28 years old at the time. And then I would move up towards Boulder, Colorado, and resume something in the electrical industry. Again, not climbing, but maybe just become an electrician in Colorado. And so I landed in South Fork on Super Bowl Sunday, the winter of 96 or the spring of 97. And the plan was not to work, was just to sort of enjoy life and take an extended holiday and fish. And I did so, and really fell in love with the small town community.
And been there ever since.
Yep. Yeah. wow. So that first year was a lot of fun. I was truly just a trout bum. I lived in a 115-year-old homesteader's cabin, heated it with a wood stove. You know, fixed broken things all the time. I mean, truly, truly the life of a trout bum.
Did you not work at all? I mean, really for that first year, essentially?
No, I don't think that first year I did. I didn't work at all. And then my 1 year anniversary came where I was supposed to move, but I had not done anything in the way of planning or thinking about it. So just like the epiphany of moving from Southern California to here, I had to have a conversation with myself and discuss, well, I like it here. Why move? And if I don't move, what will I do? And about that time, a gentleman had asked me if I wanted to take a guided trip. He had seen me on the river fishing all the time. And he said, would you like to be one of my fishing guides? No, I don't need work. I'm okay. Well, then I needed beer money or date money or something. So I took a guided trip, 4 hours. And, you know, I did a quick tutorial with him and he showed me the ropes.
Now, is this on the Rio Grande, Joel?
Yeah, this is on the Rio Grande that originates just upstream of South Fork. So I took a guided trip and at the end of the trip, you know, I made a couple $100 and the client gave me a little gratuity and I went home and I said, you know, for 4 hours of work, that was pretty fun. And I'd already come to the conclusion that if it doesn't bring me joy or I don't have a good time doing it, that I will no longer do these things in my life. Mm-hmm. So by the second summer, I was starting to take some guided trips for another business or for someone else's company.
And then that just got more regular and more regular.
Yep. Yeah. And then these were all wade trips where you walk along the Rio Grande or the South Fork River or whatever drainage. And you just, you take clients and you fish along the banks. However, there's a law in Colorado. The landowner owns the bottom of the river. That's private property underneath the water. The water is not private property. You can float through said properties, but you can't drop your anchor, get out, walk around. That's trespassing. So I saw the need for float fishing trips, but the outfitter I was working for did not want to pursue that. So I started the long process of trying to figure out how to become an outfitter and river outfitter in Colorado. And, you know, again, this is 98, 99. So the internet wasn't as great as it is now. So it took quite a while to gather all this information. And then I became a river outfitter and outfitter and started South Fork Anglers.
Oh my goodness. So
and I hired some guides.
I mean, and that's from a summer and a half or maybe a year of doing it.
Correct. Yep. So I was still early on in my guiding career, and looking back, maybe even a little too early on to venture out to start your own business. And this sort of an underlying theme with me, if I was smarter, I probably wouldn't have done it. Right? Ignorance is bliss. And I didn't know the pitfalls of outfitting because I had not been a guide long enough, but I read as much as I possibly could. I spoke to other outfitters. I tried to glean information and knowledge from those that have already made mistakes to try and prevent me from making mistakes. But, you know, any business owner, any entrepreneur is going to tell you that, they still make a ton of mistakes, and hopefully that's what we all learn from.
Well, you were 30 about that time then, weren't you? You were 30, 31.
Yep.
So kind of, that was one of my questions. How did you prepare for it? But what was your first couple of years of operations like? I mean, I can't imagine a 30-year-old me even like saying, I'm going to start this outfitter business, because you're still taking people, taking care of people, like floating them.
Yep. Yep. The analytical side is pretty easy for me. I like to do a lot of research, and I'm very, very process driven. So it was comfortable for me to make a list of processes. This is how we will take a trip. This is how we make lunches. This is what we'll do. And of course, applying those to real world events is where things can go south. It all looks good on paper.
Until you have employees or people come in, until people are clients.
You know, and I hired an attorney, and that he helped me form my first corporation, which now nowadays the internet can teach us how to do this. Mm-hmm. And I formed many, many a corporation since then. Preparing for the first couple years of business, my biggest mistake was going into that without a slush fund. I did not know I would need so much money to survive in my first years of business. I will say this, that for over 2 years, I didn't eat anything except wild game, because I could go out and harvest a deer or an elk locally during hunting season. I could not have afforded to buy steaks back then. Shoestring doesn't even come close to my budget for several years. In fact, looking back now, it's almost a bit scary to realize on how little money I survived on.
Yeah. Do you have kind of a rule of thumb now for you would tell people as far as like what you need in the slush fund before you get started?
No less than 6 months of real world living expenses. A year would be much better. I was asked to start another business in Durango. A friend wanted to open up another 8,200 mountain sports in Durango. He and his wife and I would be the partners. And we spoke, and as this progressed, I said, you must have, because they have two children. I said, you must have 12 months of a slush fund, an emergency fund. Otherwise, let's not even pursue this, because I know what I went through, and it was just me. I didn't have children or a wife. Mm. And ultimately they did not have 12 months of a slush fund. And they also were not aware of the pitfalls of early goings on for business owners. They thought it would just be, they saw where I was at, and they thought that would take place on year number one. And I assured them it would not
take place. Yeah, I'm reminded of a quote. I think Dave Ramsey says this all the time. He's like, yeah, people think I'm an overnight success. And he always says, yeah, I'm a 25-year overnight success.
Exactly.
You know, well, what, so did you, when you opened, did you have guides that were working with you? Were those salaried people, or would you pay them like commissions, or like where was all the expenses? Just all the equipment? Give us a little bit of behind the scenes.
Permitting and licensing is all up front in this type of industry. And then the guides, fishing guides, make the bulk of the money from a trip. So they were independent contractors, and they would receive at least 60% of a trip. So as long as I had enough trips coming in, I didn't really have any problem making payroll. In fact, I'm very proud to say to this day, 25 years later, we've never missed a payroll of any sort. The ancillary expenses of phone bills, commercial auto insurance, other marketing dollars are very expensive. You know, it takes money to make money, and that's something that everyone really needs to pay attention to that. I lived off of my tips for the first couple of years, because all the money, just like so many other startups, you pour everything back into that business.
Yeah. And I hope listeners who are about to start a business hear that. That's an important thing to know. It's not just you hang a sign and next thing you know, you're filthy rich. It's like these guys usually are not making anything, employees making more. And
absolutely. Payroll days, I'd cut checks, which was a very proud day for me. It was very gratifying to cut checks to these fishing guides for thousands and thousands of dollars. It made me feel very good, but I noticed I never cut myself a check.
Yeah.
You know, I'd look at my gratuities from the past week and maybe a little bit of money from the company, but it was pretty tight there for quite a while.
Well, was there a time when everything changed, like a key season or a key event in that to the Rio Grande Anglers business, where you can remember, like, I'm going to make it, or something changed, or something, you know, event happened?
It wasn't overnight. It wasn't like someone flipped a switch. I think it just, after the first couple of years, and let me stop right there. On year number two, the Rio Grande experienced the second worst drought in history. We canceled 99% of all trips. So I had to
call. For a seasonal business, who does that?
Yep. And that was the year of a fire here in South Fork. I had to call all the guides and say, okay, you're unemployed. We basically had a full season of bookings on already booked up. And I said, okay, go find work, you know, construction or what else. I ended up driving a semi that summer. I would take trips if they came in, but the Rio Grande, which would normally flow, let's say 4,000 CFS cubic feet per second, got all the way down to under 100 CFS. You and I can jump across 100 CFS in a creek. That's how small it was.
Oh my goodness.
So we couldn't fish. So it was a complete loss of revenue, but going and driving a semi locally, I actually made more money that second year. And I still took some trips to the lakes. I still tried to maintain the business. And marketing. So I was out all of that money, and I just tried to keep the business alive. So I guess back to the to answer your question is, year number three is where we saw the boom. Southerners could not come to South Fork, or did not come to South Fork, because of the fires and the drought. But in 2003, they came in droves, and we had an unbelievable summer. And by that time, financially, things had matured, and I was able to pay myself. And we had also learned from mistakes from the prior 2 years. So third year was when the light switch happened and we started doing well.
And you had to go through that terrible event too. I mean, I can't imagine your business just stopping for a year completely. I mean, I'm sure that's happened kind of in COVID, and people, I mean, that's happened But that's a pretty big deal.
It was seasonally. Huge.
What did you, looking back now, is there a kind of a key lesson you learned from that or something? Because you seem real positive to me. I mean, you kind of have a good outlook on things. I mean,
yep. Looking back now and also back then, it was understand, don't worry about what you can and what you cannot control. Let me say that again.
Yeah.
Don't worry about what you cannot control. I can't control snowpack, rainfall, the river, or any of that. So I did not focus on the past experience, which just took place. I did not focus on the fact that we're not going to have a season. Right then, I focused on how to survive the rest of the year, which turned out to be very good. So stay positive to all these newcomers that are starting their own business. Focus on the end goal, the long-term game. Again, like you said with Dave Ramsey, it's not an overnight thing. It's a 25-year thing. So focus on the end goal. The end goal was to make the best guide service on the Rio Grande. We hit a speed bump, a massive speed bump, but that didn't deter me. I did not, the following year, I still bought insurance. I still paid for all of my marketing. I bought all the permits and licenses. I even hired more guides coming off of a season where we made $0. So stay focused on the end goal and just deal with your day-to-day hurdles.
Man, that applies for everything in life.
Everything.
I'm so glad you shared that. So let's get into a little bit more business operations.
Yeah.
Must do things and must not do things for people. I mean, and you can speak to new people, but also just for us who are in the middle of operations, like you're very studious and very astute person. Like if you had to make a list, I know I'm surprising you with these questions. That's not the easy thing, but like, are there must do things you would say to make a successful business and must not do things?
Yep. Must do is research. You know, I think if you were a widget builder at a widget factory and you wanted to open up your own widget factory, you would have a base knowledge of the widget industry because you worked in a widget factory. Where my experience was really short, you know, maybe a year, year and a half before I jumped off, but I don't regret that. And I had done a lot of research. So research is number one. Okay. Understanding. And again, nowadays with online presence, there's almost unlimited resources for you to tap into, which is a huge advantage over what I had.
Yeah, information is not the excuse anymore.
No. Applying, understanding and applying that knowledge, I think is, you can be misled online. So I keep saying there's online knowledge. However, take it with a grain of salt and be very careful who you listen to online. But also keep in mind that most entrepreneurs have failed more than anybody else in the world. They fail daily at one level or another. I still do. Going back to the do is research. And then the next thing is perseverance. Do not let your failures dictate you or your business. You are going to fail. Dave Ramsey failed more times than probably most financial advisors. I can guarantee you I failed more times than most fly fishing guides, but learn from those mistakes and persevere.
And we need to hear that now. That's an important thing, I think, for kind of an accomplished based culture. Yeah. Like it's okay. But maybe some of us didn't grow up hearing that and it's okay to fail.
To this day, I still tell my employees, it's not how you screw up. It's how you get out of trouble. Right.
That's good.
I walk in, I said, you break anything? Well, we did this. Well, that's not that bad. What'd you do to fix it? You know, these things happen. You know, you were on a construction crew. You saw how things go south really fast out in the field. Okay, let's remember next time not to do that with the big truck. Let's do something different.
Yeah, and that question you ask, like, how'd you get out of it? That's the one that turns that failure into the experience you want them to grow from.
Yep, and then
that's good. You know,
especially with employees, The entrepreneur, if you have employees, focus on the positive, whether it was the business owner themselves that made the mistake or an employee. Focus on the positive of getting out of that trouble. Mm.
Well, I'm going to add your slush fund as number three as a must-do thing.
Absolutely.
What else for people? But and then I want to hit some of the don't do these things. Is there anything else that just comes to top of mind? It doesn't have to be necessarily for startups, even just like operations right now.
Patience.
Yeah.
You must have patience. You know, a lot of business owners, myself included, we're sort of alpha driven. And I don't understand why my CPA can't get my taxes done right now. I want them done now. I'm ready to have them done. But my CPA doesn't work on my schedule. Well, yeah. Suppliers don't work on my schedule. So learning patience for me has been the greatest thing. Rather than firing off that email to my attorney complaining.
Yeah, he's just sleeping over here.
Right. Why haven't you drawn up my contract? Why isn't this? It's taught me to be a little more patient. And then lo and behold, the attorney sends the email the next day. I didn't need to panic about it.
Yeah, sleep on
it. I wasted my time and energy on, again, something I can't control, which I said all the way back at the beginning, don't worry about what you can't control.
Hmm. Okay, then what about some, please, people, do not do these things.
Well, it's simple. Don't do the opposite of all those do's.
Okay. I like it. Don't be impatient. And, you know, don't be a person of perseverance. And don't do your research. Okay, that's good.
So that would be the gist of it. I think we all learn that there are 1,000,003 more don'ts than there are do's, because we as humans, we make a lot of mistakes. But again, I must say this over and over, learn from your daily mistakes. And that will help you in the long run as an entrepreneur or even as a veteran business owner.
Mm. Oh, that's good. So how do you analyze like whether or not you'd want to get involved in a business? And the reason I ask you that is because you are in a multiple different sectors. I mean, you know, real estate from the seasonal stuff and then a liquor business. So how do you make that decision if I want to get into this or not? And it doesn't have to be anything super fancy or formulaic. It makes me, you like it, but.
I'm going to focus on small town business, what I did in a small town. So I will say I'm a big fish in a small pond where you know, Austin based area, you know, your pond is a lot bigger than mine, but you're going to apply the same thing. So market research. So before starting South Fork Anglers, I had come up to the conclusion that drift boat fishing or float fishing is the way to go. Because in Colorado, not all states, like in Montana, this would not apply. But in Colorado, the landowner owns the bottom of the river. Therefore, we can't go fish all these properties, but we could if we could float through them. So right there, that goes in the positive column for me in an analytical aspect of deciding whether or not to stick with wade fishing trips or float fishing trips. I was also seeing the trend. Again, the lumber industry had ended in South Fork. The town meetings were all about a marketing strategy, tourism, fishing, hunting, skiing, rafting, etc. So that was in the positive. So I used those. I took a cue and looked at, was anybody else offering this? And if they are they offering everything I've thought of? Then if they're not offering it, why? Did they try to do what I'm thinking about and it failed? And if so, why did it fail? Mm-hmm. So again, market research within your small ecosystem. Your ecosystem would be a little bit larger than mine in South Fork. So those are some of the analytical aspects I use to determine whether to buy a business or not, or start a business. The same thing took place with 8200 Mountain Sports.
That now, was did you buy that one or did you start it?
No, I started that. There was already two ski shops in South Fork, but one of them had just gone out of business. One of them had failed. So why did I had to stand back and say, is there not enough business for two? did this person, was he just a bad business person, or did he just make some mistakes along the way that didn't lend to his success because the other ski shop was successful? So I looked at all that and then formed 8200 Mountain Sports and went headstrong into this. Again, I had not worked in a ski shop. Mm-hmm. I didn't have a lot of knowledge of the inner workings. And this goes back to what we laughed about earlier, is if I was smarter, I may have been afraid to start my business. Mm-hmm. Ignorance in this case, maybe was my friend.
Well, and I think some of the best stories of famed businesses are by people who didn't know any better. And they're like, this is something I should do and try. Yeah. And they just do it and everything's gravy.
Yeah.
I mean, it's hard. Owning a business is hard. But what I'm saying is it just, they figured out maybe even a new way to do it. And they weren't hampered by the five other people that did it before them, because they were just trying to copy what the other people did.
Correct. Yep. And if, you know, in both fishing and skiing, I enjoy those. So it was easy to.
So passion also helps. Passion. I mean, for you. Yeah. I like how you approach it, because I think some people would probably say, like, I can't make any money, period, on this business. I'm not going to pursue it. But I feel like you come about it from the angle of like, I mean, let me do my homework first. Let me do the market. And then also I like this business. And then we'll know after that if we're going to make any money or not.
Okay. When I was on top of that 95 foot pole, I told myself, or when I quit climbing, I should say, that I would never do anything again that I didn't enjoy or that didn't bring me joy ever. I just wouldn't do it. So starting a fly fishing business or a ski shop that ultimately turned into a ski shop and rafting shop, that's all sort of fun things.
Yeah.
Stress is certainly involved, but you're in the recreation industry, so you're dealing with people that shouldn't be stressed when they come to see you.
Yeah.
So I'm trying to surround myself by people that are having a good time.
Yeah. Man, I think it's a good way to approach it. And you're not saying live in a van type of deal. I mean, it's still going to be work. It's going to be hard, but you're at least going to be able to pour yourself into something that you like.
Correct.
Okay. Well, let's talk for a minute about Colorado. So for us Texans who want to get into some winter sports, and then I want to talk about summer activities and fly fishing stuff as well. What is something that we must do and when and where, as far as winter sports, and then switch to summer sports as well?
Sure. So, you know, Colorado is known for winter activities, primarily ski and snowboard based.
And you mentioned Wolf Creek's up the road from you guys.
So Wolf Creek ski area, which is 17 miles from South Fork, receives the most snow in Colorado at a ski resort annually. They average plus or minus 450 inches a year. Now, this is a ski area, whereas like Vail, that's a ski resort. They have lodging on the mountain and restaurants and retail. Wolf Creek is a ski area. So it's the old school type. You drive to it in the morning.
Okay.
There's a ski lodge where you can have meals and drinks. But at the end of the day, you check out, you know, and you come down the hill to South Fork and spend the night down there. So my suggestion is, hands down, come experience family style skiing and snowboarding at Wolf Creek. Stay in South Fork. It's still a price point driven mountain. They're, if not the least, they're the one of the least expensive resorts in all, or ski areas in all of Colorado. I think lift tickets now are about $75 a day, where you can pay double that at some of the better known resorts up along the I-70 corridor.
Yeah, so you're getting way more bang for your buck.
Amy, way more. And then lodging, like our rentals at my store are much, much less than you'd find in other areas. The restaurants are less expensive. Lodging is less expensive. So it's still a really good price point for Texas, Oklahoma, et cetera. You can be here in one day. You can ski for two or three days and then drive home in one day. Well, and of course, there's other things to do in the winter. You know,
tell us about those. I want to know about snowmobiling, cross-country skiing, ice fishing, that type of thing.
Again, with the most snow in Colorado falling right here, the snowmobiling is incredible. So there's guided tours and or rentals that you can go on. Those could be anything from a complete beginner who's never seen a snowmobile to guys that travel halfway across the country with all their own sleds. They come here because they know that there's 20 plus feet of snow underneath them And this is what they live for. Hmm. So we do see a huge market increase in snowmobile revenue in the wintertime. And these are guys that they come to town and they spend some money. So it's really welcoming. And they come in, although they may not rent skis or snowboards, they need t-shirts and other souvenirs and bric-a-brac for the family back home. So we see them on a regular basis. Cross country and snowshoe, if you're a little more active, keep in mind, cross country and snowshoeing at 8,000 to 12,000 foot above sea level takes a little bit more energy. Oh,
yeah, you can barely breathe when you walk on a mountain as is. You can't imagine with a snowshoe on.
I always preface snowshoe and cross country rentals with, "Are you sure you want to do this?" And they all look at me like, "Yeah." And about 3 hours later, they come back in. Their clothes are all torn off and disheveled, and they throw the equipment in the front door. Even though South Fork gets all this snow, and it's cold here, 20 below zero is a very, very common occurrence. The sun is out over 300 days a year. So on brutally cold winter days, the sun is still out. And if you're dressed for it, it's just still very pleasant to get out, go for hikes and walking and see the out of doors.
That's great. Well, then there's summer and fly fishing, which is dear to my heart. So it's the place to be.
Well, ski season ends the 1st of April. By then, the river has thawed out. We literally start our guided fishing program April 1. And it starts and runs April through up till about ski season starting, which is November 1.
And then if somebody wants really a great experience fly fishing on the river, you'd recommend take a guided float?
Yeah. Yep. Even for me, each time I vacation to a new river, the first thing I do is hire a guide on day one. They're going to have the intimate inside knowledge of the hatches, the river flows, what to use, when to go, not to go, et cetera. It's money well worth spent. But here's the thing. You got to do it on one of your first days. Mm-hmm. Don't fish for a week and then come to me and say, "Teach me how to fish the river on my last day," because you're going to go home and may not be back here for another year. Mm-hmm. Hiring a guide and learning the intimate knowledge. Getting intimate knowledge of the local waters is key to success. In the Rio Grande and the South Fork rivers that we have here locally, that holds true.
Do they produce some big fish?
There are nice fish. Yeah, the Rio Grande doesn't have the most fish in Colorado. It doesn't have the biggest fish in Colorado, but it's in great shape. I think now that the drainage is in better shape than it was 25 years ago when I started. The fish count is up, it's basically catch and release fly fishing
and people are going to have fun regardless. I mean,
yeah. So. Mm. Yeah.
Well, is it, I wish we could keep going longer, Joel. I'm just fascinated by even the seasonal businesses. How do you, is that a whole different animal seasonally? I mean, how do you plan and budget for that? How do you give us a feel for what it's like to run a seasonal businesses like this?
You have to be prepared. You have to be prepared for extreme highs and lows.
Okay.
And as a business owner, it does take a little bit of practice. So as June starts and we ramp up with school systems letting out for the summer, tourism starting to arrive, families arriving, we're in May, we hardly do any fly fishing. It's very, very slow. Not that the fishing is that bad, but there just isn't people in town. We're waiting for the Southerners to come north as it gets warm, right? When it gets 100 degrees for 10 days in a row, Texas leaves Texas. They all come to Colorado. So I have to have employees at the ready and ready to ramp up at a moment's notice. But then when school systems go back in, on August 21st, you can literally stand on Highway 160 in South Fork and count the hundreds and hundreds, thousands of RVs leaving town. They're all headed south.
Oh, my goodness.
So I have to be able to employ people and hold on to those people when we need them. And then they have to understand when tourism drops off, it's time for these seasonal employees to go back and work somewhere else. And fortunately, and in my world, I rely on a lot of college students. So they go back at the same time, the other kids go back to school. So it all works out pretty well for me.
And do you pull people from Texas colleges too? I mean,
absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah. So most of my rafting guides, they're customers that, you know, perhaps it's a college kid, young man or young woman that was with their family on a ski trip. And we spoke of how fun rafting is in the summertime. And I say, well, hey, kiddo, how'd you like to spend your summer rafting the Rio Grande? You know, you're going to wear flip-flops and shorts all summer long and get paid to do so.
Yeah, my wheels are turning for my boys already.
Yeah.
When they get old enough.
And believe me, I plant the seed early. You know,
okay, everybody who's listening, hear this.
When I see a 12-year-old kid come in the store and he's telling me how he likes to go rafting, I say, well, in 6 years, you come and see me.
Yeah.
You have I work on that year round, making sure I can acquire seasonal help.
Well, maybe somebody listening to this will make a note in show notes. Just like, hey, if you need resumes, send it here. And
fishing guides and rafting guides. Come apply.
How many people do you need usually kind of at the max for like a rafting or fishing season?
Fishing season could get up to 8 to 10 fishing guides. Of course, there's administrative staff. Those guys I typically employ year round. They work for me in one form or another. The fishing guides our season is only summertime here. As I said, it's seasonal. So they have to have another job. Now, sometimes they still work for me in the ski shop.
Okay.
So that's even better for me because then they don't disappear on me. They don't get squirrely in the middle of winter and move. And then, then we don't have them in the summertime. The rafting guides, that's a different breed. You know, this is the raft guides live in tents and vans down by the river. Literally, okay. They're sort of fly by night. But same thing, I'll pick up a half a dozen guides, a couple drivers, a couple support staff. College kids are the go-to on that. You know, there's not many 45-year-old rafting guides.
Yeah, but you know that going into it, you know, hey, these guys are going to bless them, give them something to do in the meantime, and they're probably going to be gone. And
yeah, and that's normal. And if they come back for a second season, that's a perk. Many don't. Many of the rafting guides, they're, you know, or maybe they graduated college and they're just off on to an internship or doing something else. And that I do also support the idea, and I've used outdoor recreation college programs. So someone may be going into recreation management as their degree, and we do paid internships. So they may be a rafting guide 2 or 3 days a week, but in order to qualify for their credits, we bring them in on the carpet, put them in inside, and they learn how to do the books. They learn how to book trips. And so that's always fun to get a young intern, but it's a paid position as well.
What an incredible opportunity for them too, for somebody who's done it as long.
Yeah.
Mm. Well, let's talk about the liquor store just for a second. And have you had that very long?
6 years.
It's okay.
The liquor store where it sits now has been a liquor store for over 110 years.
Okay.
It was actually in South Fork. We have a picture from the early 1900s, and you can see the sign on top of the roof that says liquor.
Oh, wow.
So
that was, as far as analyzing that one, I mean, it's kind of a no-brainer on that situation.
That was a no-brainer. That didn't take a whole bunch of thought. What happened with me was I owned a small restaurant in town. And when I sold the restaurant, I realized I had exposed myself to 100% water-based activities, snowing and rafting and fishing and skiing. So if I had a bad snow year, I could have a bad everything year.
Oh, wow. What a realization.
And so the restaurant was great. We did well. Basically, I flipped it in 3 years, doubled my money. It was great. So we talked a little bit about what I do to analyze these businesses. Well, I looked around. What's one of the safest businesses in South Fork? Well, the grocery store and the gas station, but they were millions and millions of dollars. They were for sale. Well, I walked into the liquor store and the couple had had it for 15 years. And I said, if you ever want to sell, let me know. Mm-hmm. And I bought my bottle of bourbon and I walked out. They told me no. 3 days later, they called and they said, well, we've been thinking about it.
Okay. That's it.
And that was it. 3 weeks later, it was mine. It happened that fast.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Talk about timing, then perfect timing.
Yeah. And they had others that offered to buy it over the years. And, you know, and it's the only liquor store in a small town. So it's people drink when they're sad and then people drink when they're happy. And I don't want to say they drink more when they're sad or when they're happy. It's a pretty steady business.
Well, I don't know, since you've owned it for 6 years, can you say, like, what is the best bourbon somebody should buy?
Yeah, I was just going to ask him that. Well, like, what did you buy when you walked out of that?
Yeah. So bourbon, the bourbon craze for the younger generation, it's really made bourbon hard to acquire. So if you can find a bottle of Blanton's, that's incredible. We get one bottle about every 4 weeks. W.L. Weller 12 is very, very hard to come by. So rather than trying to go with these ones that are super hard to acquire, you know, you can go to your second or third choice. So we focus in on a lot of Colorado-based distilleries. Breckenridge Bourbon and Laws Whiskey out of Denver are incredibly popular. And I'd put them up against Blanton's in a taste test. For me, Breckenridge Bourbon is great.
That's really cool. And that you still support Colorado, and like, I appreciate that about you. That's neat.
And we bring in, and also because we cater to the Texan or Southerner, we bring in a lot of Texas-based alcohol, you know, so the simple one is Tito's, right? Mm. Everybody drinks Tito's, Dripping Springs vodka, Texas whiskey.
They like to see what they see down here.
Yeah.
Up there so too. Yeah.
Feel, you know, and a little strange fact is we are the number one seller of Tito's vodka in the state of Colorado at a mom and pop level. Now we don't, we don't compete with like Bevco or, you know, Costco, but at a mom and pop level, we sell more Tito's than any other small store in the state.
Mm. You're doing great on all your, go ahead, Micah.
Yeah. I was going to say, we know a pretty good story of Wellers on top of a mountain.
Oh, okay.
We'll have to tell you
Wellers,
up there
Wellers
on that
at high altitude is a whole nother level.
When we're not recording, I want to hear this.
cut the Southerners off sometime. So what's next for you, Joel? And we'll kind of wrap it up just to, you know, honor your time. Do you think there's a next business in mind or next thing?
Yeah, I'm always investigating another venture. I don't, in it, it's probably more regional. I'm probably getting into more of, you touched base on it a little bit earlier, but the real estate lending. If I were to sell businesses, I would capitalize on that and use those funds to help startup real estate companies or real estate investors, where I lend money for them to flip houses. I started flipping houses years ago, and then I was borrowing money and realized that, you know, this guy I borrowed $100,000 from, he did okay on this deal, you know? So I started then saving my pennies and lending that. And so I think I'll get more into, you know, again, not necessarily venture capitalist. I don't want an equity share in anything, but rather like a bank or a private.
Yeah. Like a hard money lender too.
Hard money lender, yeah. Private money lender. You know, and just, that just depends on, there are times when money is readily available, when interest rates are very favorable via other more conventional sources. However, there's been times when I lend money at 18 and 20%.
Yeah.
And there's times right now I'm, you know, 8 and 10% perhaps.
Yeah. Well, a lot of the real estate kind of investors and flippers, a lot of times they're not going to want to go through conventional lending because they want it quick and now and fast.
They want it quick. Yeah. You know, a lot of times these phone calls come about 10 o'clock at night and say, I need X amount of dollars in the next 20 minutes. And otherwise someone else will get this. And now what I've gotten into is lending to these larger groups too, that buy hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of doors at one time for millions of dollars. And they're utilizing private funds from many lenders. So yeah. I have a small share, but there's a lot of there's a lot of safety, a lot of security in that type of lending for me.
Yeah. Well, I sure appreciate all you're doing and all you've done and all your, you know, volunteer work in South Fork as well.
Thank you.
Let's wrap it up. If I had to ask you, this is kind of a tough question, but if I had to ask you, like, hey, what's a life message for you? And it might be or an encouragement for people. Did something come up?
Life message.
Like, what's your life message to people as an encouragement?
Live a good life. You know, for lack of better terms, you may have heard people say, I live a Christian life. So not everyone is religious or Christian, but live a life that your mother would be proud of.
Yeah.
Do things, you know, do unto others as you'd have done to you.
Yeah.
That's a simple theory to move forward.
Yeah.
Mine was I'm only going to pursue things that I thoroughly enjoy. Yeah. I'm not going to start a business that I don't like, or I'm not going to go on a vacation, or I'm not going to act in a way that I don't like, because chances are others would not like that.
That's really good. I like how you approach kind of life and business that way too, because I really think it makes you more successful. You're going to do the stuff you enjoy and you're going to do it well.
Be lighthearted, you know, be lighthearted. Again, I'm in the recreation industry. I really shouldn't have to deal with people who are on vacation that are in a bad mood. You know, who's in a bad mood on vacation? They're going fishing. Hey, that's a fun thing. Well, we're going rafting or skiing, snowboarding. Those are all fun things. So I want to see people walk in, smile and say hello, because we're going to smile and say hello because they're on vacation and they should be having a fun time.
That's great. I appreciate that. Well, and just to talk about 8200, man. I mean, I've dealt with you guys quite a bit in the past and your guys have been great to deal with. So tell people, how can we connect? How do we connect with you? And then, you know, if you come to South Fork, you know, how do we get our winter gear and our summer gear?
Yep.
Is it all at 8200? Tell us a little bit about where you're at and how to find you.
Instagram, Facebook, and website are all 8200 Mountain Sports or Mountain Man Rafting. All the information is there online. Again, in the wintertime, rentals for Wolf Creek Ski Area, skis and snowboards, cross country, snowshoes, and of course, all the goodies to go with it. In the summertime, guided fly fishing trips, guided rafting. We also do rentals of rafts, fishing rafts, kayaks, stand up paddle boards, and inner tubes, and a full fly shop. And again, all the souvenirs and bric-a-brac that all the tourists want.
That's perfect.
And in a small town like South Fork, you just ask, you know, South Fork is only 1 mile long and you say, where is 8200? Everybody knows.
Yeah. Well, it's a great store and I can say that from personal testimony.
Well,
thank you. They'll treat you right. And Joel, thank you for making time today.
Hey, thank
you. It's a blessing to have you on and look forward to what's coming up for you in the future. So,
all right, guys, I appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. We'll see you when you come back to South Fork.
Yes, sir. Hopefully soon.
Hey, this is Micah. Me and Josh would like to thank you for joining us in the Story Field today. We hope you've enjoyed our discussion, and to learn more about us and the Story Field, visit thestoryfield.com. This podcast is sponsored by The Allen Firm, legal guides for many of life's situations. To learn more about The Allen Firm, visit allenlawfirm.com. Have a blessed day, week, and year, and we will see you next time on The Story Field.
This is Josh again. I just wanted to thank you for listening and let you know that this podcast is really about hope and about giving you hope for your life. So if you're listening and you're in a place where you're really feeling hopeless right now, or if you do not know Jesus, we have some great news to share with you and would love a chance to pray for you. Email us at hope@allenlawfirm.com. That's hope@allenlawfirm.com. And we'll reach out to you soon. Thank you for listening. God bless you.